Hello, my name's Jamie Gordon.
And I'm Ginny Carlin.
And this is the BFBS podcast, Mav Geeks, a military aircraft obsession.
So if you haven't joined us before, I work for BFBS out in Canada.
And I work for BFBS over near Sheffield in the UK. We have five series of our podcasts for you to trawl through on these cold winter nights. Or if you're in the Southern Hemisphere, hello Falklands, for you to enjoy on a long summer's day.
Minus 20 here today, Jamie. What he hasn't told you, though, is that there will be a test at the end of all five series of Mav Geeks. So when you've listened to it, those without a perfect 100% score will be subjected to Jamie talking for 6 hours about flying in an F4 Phantom again. You have been warned.
You really know how to hurt a boy, don't you? It's very harsh, Ginster. But I'm sure I could tell you about it for at least another hour. Then you'd be sorry. Anyway, it's been a lively week in the week of aviation. What have you got for us?
Oh, gosh, Jamie, this popped up on my feed earlier on this week. I had to post it on my own social media where I have got a lot of people who aren't yet Mav Geeks. And that is, I can't even pronounce it, the Domodedovo Airlines, which is a Russian airline. I'm pretty sure if people have ever heard of it, they'll be like, that's a really bad pronunciation, Ginster. They had an Ilyushin 96 that had been in storage for 10 years. They basically took the engines off it. And then by the look of it, it's not been stored inside. Anyway, they decided to take it for a flight. Not just like, oh yeah, we need to prep it and test it and everything. Stuck the engines on the second go it took off, and they were away. They just took it after 10 years and flew it.
Can you just imagine the conversation going on there? Right, boys, short straw then, and then you get to fly this plane for the first time in 10 years, and we've done absolutely nothing with it. Here you go, Vladimir. I mean, it's crazy.
I know, it's mad. And to look at it, right? So it reminds me, 20 years ago, I used to have a white Ford Escort. I know, Jamie, I know what you're thinking. But I did have a white Ford Escort. And when I joined BFBS, I left it at my mum's, on my mum's drive. And the top of it went green because, you know, like when you leave something outside and the weather gets to it and there's leaves on it and stuff like that. This plane, have you seen it? It's not even been cleaned. It's got all like the green moss and stuff on top where it's been left outside.
It was absolutely filthy. I couldn't believe what I was watching.
Also, Jamie, for your delectation today, a bit of an aviation little nugget came up in my feeds this week about the world's smallest airport. It has a runway, right, has a runway so short that planes need a waiver to land. Now, we all know about kind of like airfields and, you know, little grass strips, but this is actually a country's airport. Have you ever heard of the Dutch Caribbean island of Saba?
I think I have, but I don't know why. And it's not about their airport, I don't think.
Oh, my gosh. So it has, let me get this right. It's a day of pronunciations today, Jamie. And to be fair, I'm pretty awful. Joancho E. Erauskin Airport. It has the shortest...
Go on. One more time.
I'm not saying it again. You. Getting me back now, aren't you? It's got the shortest commercial runway. And just tell me how long you think it might be.
Ooh, 1,000 foot?
I'll give you another clue, Jamie, that major international airports have runways measuring more than 3,000 metres, in some cases more than 4,000. So try again. I was going to say, that fact's not going to help you at all, by the way, I've just given you. It is. It's 400 metres long.
Get away. You can't even
Seriously.
Do an F-35 vertical takeoff on that. That's ridiculous.
What do they land on it? Very, very tiny planes.
Tiny pilots.
We could go on forever on that. But it's really weird because it looks like a doll's house airport. You know what I mean? And when you look at it, it's just... It's like what you would find at one of these like model village places, but actually planes do land on it.
I'd imagine you'd probably get a Cessna down there as long as it could do a handbrake turn.
Well, I will send you the... there's something on YouTube about somebody landing there and it looks like a Cessna. Basically, you know, as soon as they land, they're like, whoa, before they go off the end of the runway into the sea. But it's pretty mad. And considering that... you know, it is an international airport and they have about 6 flights a day going in and out, but on very, very tiny planes, as we said.
As always with you, Ginny, every day is a school day. Now, here at MavGeeks, we usually speak to pilots and engineers, but this week we have something a little bit different. We're speaking to Russ, who played a critical part in keeping his aircraft and crew safe in some very hostile environments in Iraq and Afghanistan as a door gunner, primarily on the Lynx, but he flew some other helicopter types as well. It's a real eye-opening listen.
Just to say, though, before we start, for obvious reasons, we are talking with Russ about Iraq and Afghanistan and conflict. And we appreciate that for some, it might be a little bit difficult to hear or talk about. If that is you, there is support available should you need it at bfbs.com/audience support. Anyway, here's the brilliant Russ. Oh, Russ, thank you so much for joining us today on MavGeeks. It's a real pleasure to have you. First of all, before we go any further, can we have your history, how you started in the military and so many questions just coming out in a garbled mess? But what led you down this kind of aviation path?
Yeah, morning, Ginny. So thank you for having me on the show. So essentially, I was classic troubled childhood, needed to get out of the home and joined the cadets. I got into it quite a young age at 13, and one of the instructors had a bright blue beret, and I thought, well, that's different to what everyone else is wearing. I think we was engineers when we was in the cadets, and I sort of asked him, I said, you know, what's your background? Why is that colour? And he said, oh, I was a door gunner. And I said, what's that? And he said, it's a guy that sits in the back of a helicopter. You know, he'd done Desert Storm 1, so the Gulf War 1, and it fascinated me. The job itself fascinated me, and I thought, I want to do that when I get older. So essentially, I joined the army at 18. They pushed me originally down a few other different routes, but I said, no, I want to join the Army Air Corps. And you can't join as a door gunner, unfortunately. You have to do a certain amount of time, become a what they call class one ground crew, so you understand the mechanics of everything before you can be selected to go on the aviation, what is now known as the aviation crewman course. But back then it was just a door gunner's course. So I did about 4 years, did multiple tours on the ground, and then, yeah, put my name in the hat, and I was quite fortunate. I got on the course straight away. It was 7 weeks long and essentially focused mostly on door gunnery. So shooting from a helicopter. So 7.62 and 50 cal. So 50 caliber machine guns. As time went on, they realized that, hey, these guys in the back of the aircraft, you know, they can do other things other than just shoot. Whereas now we're at the point where it's a joint air crewman's course. I think it's 6 months long and you learn everything from map reading, emergencies, etc. Whereas we were learning on the bounce as time went on. But I thrust myself into that. I think 2007, I passed the course. And I think, if I remember rightly, I got about 13 hours on the course. So 13 logged hours. And I went to Iraq for my third tour, but first flying tour in 2007 with, I think I left with 26 hours. And yeah, the learning curve was extremely steep. I was the junior guy on the team. There was four of us that was out there. And they were all senior to me. So yeah, my learning curve was extremely tight. But yeah, it was good. And from there, I was absorbed by it. Then it was different. The wars were different. Whereas now the course has developed in a way that you're an integral part of the crew. So that's kind of how it started, really.
So what specific qualities are required for a door gunner then? I mean, how do you integrate into that very small team?
So initially, it was a fitness test because you're known as the trunk monkey.
the trunk monkey
as we were commonly known as. You would carry the machine gun, the ammunition, the kit and equipment, all that sort of thing. So you had to be relatively fit because you pilots would carry pistols and rifles, you would carry a pistol and a machine gun, so you had to be a lot fitter. And we make a common joke that pilots was just sandbags for door gunners, you know, so we were having to carry all this stuff for them. But that was the first criteria to pass the fitness test, be fully fit to attend. You had to be a class one ground crew. So you had to understand helicopter landing sites. You had to be proficient in that. And that really sets you up to be a Lance Corporal before you went on the course. So you pass that course, you become a class one soldier and a Lance Corporal, and then you can just put your name into a hat. Back then, there was no aptitude test. So it was like, are you fit enough? Are you a class one ground crew? This individual can go put the papers in to go on the course. Now you have to pass an aptitude test, similar to what the pilots do to see if you're fit enough for air crew. So it's developed again. But that was kind of the criteria to be on just to get on the course. Then from the course, you had all of your ground role training, and then you go into your air role training. So shoot from the aircraft and a number of sort of tactical training scenarios that you have to pass. I think there was a course of, I think there was eight on my course, and eight passed, six army guys and two
Royal Marines for the Navy.
So, Russ, I always think there must be such a lot of pressure on a door gunner. I'm just thinking back to my time where in Afghanistan, where I hitched a lift somewhere and with the Royal Marines, and I ended up on a helicopter with, there was a colour sergeant, myself, and a door gunner, and loads of mail. So obviously everybody was really excited about that. But I watched the door gunner the whole time, and it was just at the start of the Afghan fighting season. So everybody was like, you know, quite on tenterhooks, really. And we got on, he was locked in. You know what I mean? Even I think if somebody had come and prodded him on the shoulder, he wouldn't have even took his eyes off it. What are the kind of things that you are looking for? Because when I used to look out at the desert, I couldn't see anything apart from sand. What are the things that you train to look for?
So depending on theatre. So essentially in Iraq, I did 4 tours of Iraq, but 2 were flying tours. And we flew a different profile in Iraq to we did to Afghanistan. Iraq was quite built up. It was in Basra Air Station, which was a stone's throw away from the city. We then worked out that flying high over the city was not good practice because they had a longer time to lock onto us as a target. So we used to fly everywhere at 50 feet. So, you know, you'd fly over the houses, wires being the biggest thing. So a big threat would be wires or, you know, when I say wires, I'm talking telegraph poles, you know, internet connections, things like that, which is obviously bad juju for aircraft. So non-threatening things that we would look for are flags, flagpoles, wires, things like that. So just normal run-of-the-day stuff that you'd expect in a city or a built-up area. Those are the sorts of things that we would highlight. Birds is a big one. You have a bird strike and there's like famous pictures of like bald eagles being into like aircraft cockpits and things like that. So those are the sorts of things we're looking at from a non-hostile perspective. Because, you know, the pilots are busy, they're flying, they're looking out, but you've got a different set of eyes from a different perspective of the aircraft. So you can pick up on these sorts of things. Obviously, from a hostile perspective, you're looking for, you know, the guys with weapon systems or, you know, in a hostile posture, guys that are setting up mortar base plates. At night, you're seeing things like tracer or gunfire, smoke trails from RPGs, things like that. In Afghanistan, we flew a different profile completely. We flew high because we had the defensive aid suite to protect us from certain surface-to-air missiles that enabled us to fly at 5,000 feet. You know, so we didn't fly anywhere at 10 feet. We flew everywhere at 5,000 feet originally. So we got out. Like you said, Jeannie, you'd fly over the desert and it would just be the desert. And it's quite, you know, monotonous until you get to the green zone. Into the green zone, we would fly slightly lower and we would do our bits and pieces. So you mentioned there the mail run when you was on the back of a Sea King or a Chinook or whatever it was. If we were doing, I remember 2009 Christmas Day, we was the only aircraft that flew Lynx Mark 7. We flew to every forward operating base in the green zone in Sangin Valley to drop off Christmas presents to everyone that's out there. And that's where you were flying at 5,000 feet. Last minute, you tip in, land at the FOB, kick out 2 MFO boxes of morale, and then lift again. So it's different profile. Again, same detail though. You're looking for wires and flags and Taliban fighters or hostile, what we call dickers. So guys that would sit on hills with a radio and then call in to, so if we were like escorting a convoy, they would have a guy that would be sat on a hill with a radio talking in a mortar team to say, yeah, your mortars are, you know, 100 meters to the north. The ground troops could find that individual and say, we've got a dicker that's at this location approximately, can you identify him? Or we would pick that out individually, so we think you've got a dicker that's calling in that mortar fire. So those are the sorts of things you're looking at. Again, at night it's a lot more difficult to spot one guy running around, so you was on night vision goggles at night, and again the threat would be gunfire, smoke trails, things like that that you was sort of looking at. Obviously, for our own troops, they would have fireflies to IR strobes, so we could differentiate between the two parties on the ground. So it's a completely different perspective. You know, we're not having to look so much at dials and things like that, whereas the air crew are. There's a time and place for that. So in emergency situations when, you know, they've got problems with the cockpit, we are then a third set of eyes that could look in and have a conscious decision to say, hey, have you noticed this? Have you noticed that? Etc. But that's kind of what we're looking for, really, in a wartime environment.
And I know it'll change on the sortie, the mission, the profile, but as a door gunner, are you there defensively or offensively? And how does it change and who calls that change?
So depending on the task, so a lot of the times you're defensive. So you are, sometimes you're a deterrent because of your presence, you know, and you've got a convoy of 100 vehicles that are driving through the desert, but there's 2 aircraft that are faster than any vehicle that can, you know, prosecute target, etc. So your defensive, your presence there can be just a deterrent. I've done 5 tours of Afghanistan, 2 from what I call Green Fleet, 3 from what they call Black Fleet, so with the Hereford, and that is definitely offensive. So that's completely separate.
and I will be careful what I say, but you'll get the gist of it. We would hunt targets that we knew were active and in an area where we would go and prosecute them, and we would definitely be on an offensive. So that doesn't mean that we would go out and what we call do a vehicle interdiction, so a hard stop of a vehicle. We know that there's a key player in that vehicle that's escaping to a border close to Afghanistan, Pakistan, let's face it. And what they were doing was they were selling their heroin for arms, IEDs, you know, RPGs, whatever it may be. And we were stopping those vehicles. And then essentially the guys that we worked with were getting out of another aircraft and they would detain them. And then obviously we pull the information from them and then the network, that's how we sort of brought down networks. You could be in a defensive, so you could fly into the green zone, dropping off, I don't know, ammunition supply or whatever, or going to pick up someone who's on a compassionate, you know. This was my previous two tours. So you would say, look, we need to go in at night. We can only land once. It's the fastest aircraft. Let's get them in. You'll have an Apache generally above them if it's at night for that sort of stuff. We'd go in and get a compé. But essentially, you get a compassionate case out on your lift. There's a beer guy that will take a pot shot. And you go very quickly from defensive, just picking up an individual to get them home, to offensive. And then you're putting rounds back down range to get you out of trouble. And he said something else then, but out of trouble.
Blimey. I keep saying blimey a lot, Russ. I'm sorry.
It's all right. No, it's good. It's good. I don't think I've ever actually spoken about this, really. So it's quite interesting to see what comes out of my mouth.
Wow, blimey. That's what's coming out of my mouth this whole time. Let's just get on to the aircraft. You spoke a little bit off air that you'd been on the Lynx Mark 7. That's where you'd started. And you said it had skids.
Yeah.
Tell us about that. That just sounds crazy.
So I don't know if you sort of, essentially, a skid is, it's like a long pole, basically. You have two of them and that's what you land on. It's really, you can stand, you know, you can stand on it. It's quite dynamic. You can take them off and you can put skis on, believe it or not. So we used to go to Norway and you would take the skids off and you would put skis on, like really large skis. When you land, you didn't then obviously dig the skids in. You would land on skis and you'd do exactly how you would. You wouldn't obviously do a ski stop or a snow plow, but you would land and then just glide to a stop. It's quite diverse. That was the Mark 7. The Mark 9, we basically traded that in, similar to what the Navy had, which was, they had 9s, was the wheels. Because what you can do with a Mark 9 and Mark 9 Alpha, as it became when the engines changed, was you could do run-in takeoffs. So you could have a heavier load, you'd have a runway, and you could basically build up speed before you lift off, like a plane, effectively. And it was easier to land, easier to take off, and it's a bit more diverse in that respect. So they had the uplift from the old Rolls-Royce engines to T-800 engine, which gave it a lot more power. And that's when it became the 9 Alpha. And then the Mark 7 was retired and the 9 Alpha came in. And then my last three tours of Afghan were on the 9 Alpha. And they were fantastic. A bit more lift. You could operate them in the sun, in the heat. Whereas before the 7, there was a time, I think I finished my flying career with just over 2,000 hours. But there was a time where I had more flying on night vision than I did in the day because we were flying at night so much in Iraq because of the heat, the temperature in the day forced us to fly at night. And a lot of the ops were going in at night. So we had the advantage with night vision and IR.
And how did the Lynx Mark 9 compare with similar type of helicopters used by other forces? Was it regarded as, you know, the best of the best?
So I don't know if it still is, but I think it still holds a record for the fastest aircraft, fastest rotary. Don't get me wrong, I don't think there was anything in the aircraft when they made that world record. They stripped out everything. They just had like one radio, you know, but it was the fastest aircraft. What it had the ability to do was stop on a sixpence. It was really good. So you could fly at, you know, 180, 200 knots, no problem, and it would stop very, very quickly. So when we were doing hard stops on cars, you'd be able to stop easily. You're a small aircraft, so you would fly in their 6 o'clock position so they couldn't see you in their rear view. Whereas a Chinook, or the cow as we used to call it, the Chinook, you know, Chinook's great because it can lift, you know, 30, 40 troops, you know, good to go, loads of freight, Land Rovers, whatever. That's a fantastic aircraft. We didn't have that capability. So we would be able to, we limited ourselves in Afghanistan to realistically the two front seat, or the aircraft commander, the aircraft pilot, of which I'll quickly note, the aircraft commander is the senior of the two people in the front. Both of them have done the same course. They're just more experienced. They've done their commander's check. So that individual signs for the aircraft. However, the commander generally commands the aircraft. The pilot flies the aircraft. In the RAF, it's very different. So the commander
has signed for that aircraft, so he will fly that aircraft or she will fly that aircraft. So it's very different, Army and Air Force, slightly different. And we'd have those two guys at the front or girls at the front, then it'd be myself in the back, and then generally we'd have two snipers in the back. And we just went as a three crew. That's kind of how we rolled out on those tours, just the five of us as a crew. However, you do have the ability to carry up to 9 troops, believe it or not, in the Lynx. So the 9 Alpha originally was, you had 3 seats at the back, which we always kept in, and then you could have a 4 or a 6 seat that would put in, and everyone would be harnessed in or seatbelted in. The problem with the seats in the middle, it's very restrictive. You can't move around the aircraft. It's very difficult to go from one door to the other. So 9 times out of 10, we would have that seat removed in Afghanistan, and we just have the 3 seats in the back. That meant that in the event of an incident where we had to strap in, the 2 snipers and myself would be able to get into one of those seats, which is a crash-worthy seat, supposedly. You could put a seatbelt on and you'd be able to accept the landing. Whereas if you had 4 or 5 people, 2 people haven't got a seat to get into. So it was a bit of a trade-up, effectively. But we could carry, depending on the heat and the temperature, obviously fuel. I think it was 750 kilos of fuel that we could take, which is approximately 2 hours flying time, which would give you, you know, if it's 10 minutes out to target, it would give you some time, you know, an hour and 40 minutes on target before you have to come back. And then you'd be absolutely have no fuel. We never used to come back empty, because if there was an incident on the airfield where you couldn't land for 10, 15 minutes, you know, we call it bingo fuel. So you'd have to come back knowing that we've got a bit of spare in case something happens. But yeah, we have a max capacity. I'm not even going to tell you what the figures are, but essentially we could carry 9 people. We'd have to carry less fuel. What we were very good at, though, is just the 3 crew in Afghan. So the 2 front seaters, as we call them, and myself, with a load of freight, MFO boxes full of morale, ammunition, stores, that sort of thing. We was very good at that. But it's a multi-role helicopter. So I did all my instructor quals in like abseiling. So you can abseil from a helicopter, 180 feet maximum. So I think it works out about 150 feet that you can abseil. Fast roping. So you'd fast rope people onto buildings for an easy access. So instead of having to land, if you couldn't land, you drop the rope down and they would be able to fast rope down. The longest fast rope I've done was, so the longest fast rope you can get is a 90-foot rope, which is approximately about 75 feet that you'll do with your, make sure you've got a tail on the floor, at night onto a frigate, which was at sea, which is pretty cool. So you could do parachuting from a helicopter, from the Lynx. You can do low-level dispatch, so essentially throw people out into the sea from 10 feet. So you'd basically go 10 feet above the sea and you'd throw these guys out who would then do, you know, marine type jobs onto boats or whatever. Camera systems, recce. Yeah, it's very, very diverse aircraft. I loved it. It was great.
Swiss Army knife, really.
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, it was cool.
Russ, just going back to what you were saying about like offensively and defensively, how accurate was the gun that you were firing? How accurate were you? And how many times did you have to make contact when you were out sort of typically? Was it every time you were out, or was it sort of once or twice a week?
So unfortunately, the accuracy of, so the general purpose machine gun, the GMP, GPMG, was common 7.62. That would be, we'd use that regularly. We'd also have the 50 cal, which was obviously 50 caliber, so 12.7 mil, which is like a bigger round. The accuracy purely depends on the person behind the gun. So you would have guys that were die hard on the range as much as possible. You would have guys that would keep a currency. Other units I was at, you were selected to go there because of the caliber of person, I suppose. So you was naturally a better shot. You naturally wanted to be on the range longer. So it truly depends on the firer and, if I'm brutally honest, the person flying at the time. Generally, you would have the commander in the right-hand seat and the pilot in the left-hand seat. Certainly when I was in Afghan, because the gun was on the right-hand side. So your gun controller would be your commander. So as you're firing, they would be able to see your splash, et cetera, of your rounds. On a typical week, so first 2 tours was very defensive operations, I would say. You know, you could just be delivering mail and then you could be on the way back and there would be some troops in contact that would call for any call sign in the area, which we were. We would go and assist. But it wasn't a daily occurrence. It was every now and again. Then we'd have like a spate where we'd get into contacts quite a lot and then we'd be nothing for 2 weeks, you know, and it was kind of like that. My last 3 tours, it was deliberate offensive. So we were going out to stop vehicles, going out to stop people, or going on deliberate operations where we knew it was going to be punchy. So we knew we were going to be in for a scrap. And that was, if I'm brutally honest, a daily occurrence for 3 to 4 months, I think the tours were on those ones. 4 months. Generally, you used to do like 6 month tours, and they realized in the last 2 months of aviation tours, you start to make mistakes because you're accumulative fatigue. And then obviously, if you make mistakes, that's when accidents happen. So they cut our tours down to 4 months, and then we just rotate through on a 4 month tour. But they were quite punchy, quite spicy, actually. Yeah, and a lot of contacts happened. But again, a lot of the time we had the upper hand. You know, if you've got some diehard Taliban fighters that are fleeing and they want to get out and fight, we're in an advantage that I'm in a helicopter with a 50 cal and they've got 7.62 AK-47s. You know, I'm going to win 9 times out of 10. But yeah, so I can't give you an exact figure. If I look from my logbook, I could tell you how many contacts I've been in. It's a fair amount, but I couldn't give that figure now. But yeah, it's quite, you know, it was up and down. But those tours for certain, the last three were offensive and we were busy.
Russ, I'm honestly dying to ask you, what are the times that really you remember that stick out to you? Are there any stories of when you were perhaps out in the helicopter doing stuff that you can share with us?
So I've got loads, if I'm honest. I'll go back to Iraq 2008. So my first tour of Iraq was in 2004, and I was on the ground. I was in a place called Alamara, which was between Baghdad and Basra. And it was like a tiny little fob, or it wasn't tiny, but small fob in comparison to the other two. And I remember working up there. We used to do 2 week rotations. So we'd go up there, we'd do 2 weeks up there, do some jobs, then we'd rotate with the next crew. And essentially that was to stop that cumulative fatigue of what we were doing. 2008, I remember going up there as the last aircraft, the two last links. We landed in there, we got the last individuals out, and the warrior tanks were all on the essentially the four corners of Alamara, of the base, Camp Abenaji it was called. And I remember lifting from there, the warriors, the CO was on the ground, he called, you know, clear for the aircraft to lift. As soon as we lifted out, the four warriors rolled out of Camp Abenaji and we left everything. And I remember watching the locals jump the walls, come through the gate and just rip off things like, I don't know, the aircon units, the kitchen, whatever. And it was like something out of World War Z. And I remember flying away from there thinking, you know, I'll never return here because that was that time done. Basra Palace was tricky. So originally the Chinooks were out there and they obviously then got pulled to Afghanistan and the Merlin became the MERT team. But their serviceability let them down in the early stages of Iraq in 2007, if I'm brutally honest. So we would fly at night and we would go into Basra Palace, and that was always a punchy affair, you know, because they knew we were coming. The guys used a bit of sort of like psychological warfare. So they had like, you know, they would play the sounds of helicopters landing throughout the whole night, knowing we was going to land at 3 o'clock in the morning, because the locals would be like, there's a helicopter, or the Al-Qaeda would be like, there's a helicopter coming. They'd look, they'd be known. And then, you know, 20 minutes later, the music would play and it would be the sound of a helicopter. They'd go out to look and eventually they'd get bored of this. And then we would actually land and extract people out, things like that.
That's very sneaky.
Yeah, so, but it was always quite punchy. You know, you'd fly over 50 feet over these houses and there'd be people that were sleeping on, you know, just local populace that were just sleeping in their sleeping bags on the roof because it was cooler at night. It's quite weird to see that. I think Afghanistan was a different kettle of fish. So again, different level of combat as such. We would go out and, like I said, prosecute hard targets who were bad people. And again, I'd be careful what I say. I do remember once that I made a mistake and we were marking the vehicles. So guys had run away from the vehicles and we were marking the guys who we were working with. We were on the ground searching for these individuals, which we rounded up, no problem. And essentially they get detained. We'd get them in the back of the aircraft. We'd fly them to one of the local camps where they would be detained and then questioned, etc. And I do remember once marking a car that was empty and the guys had said, hey, you know, we can't find the Charlie. Where is it? And I said, oh, it's in this location. So I dropped a smoke grenade to mark where that was. But I actually hit the back of the vehicle. What I didn't check was, and it was pretty poor of me, was that was a red phosphorus grenade. So it actually blew the car up. So I was hated for about 3 days. And my team leader, who was a staff sergeant in one of the Sabre squadrons, wanted to punch my head in, I think. I regained it about three or four days later, I think it was. We hard targeted a car and I watched the guy in the back throw something out of the car. And when we stopped the car, the guys got on off the lifter. They went in, searched it. It was like, yeah, there's nothing here. It's a dry hole. And I said, look, that guy threw something out the back of the aircraft. And I remember the TL saying, no, there's nothing, blah, blah, blah. And I said, look, I said to us, by begging my commander, I was like, let me put this right. The guy threw something out of the car. So in the end, we made a decision to land on. I walked out about 100 meters to find what was luckily a mobile phone that he'd actually thrown out. And I was like, oh, and then the TL liked me again and high-fived me, all was forgotten. And I was like, that's what he dropped out. And luckily that phone had a lot of the information from the previous 3 days that I destroyed inadvertently. But I mean, I can still see now, Christmas Day, 2009, in the green zone, we landed at Fobshaw Cap, and I still remember the bloke. I can still see him now. If I close my eyes, I can still see him now. He was sat on sentry duty, middle of the day. I landed on. We told him we were coming in. They didn't have to come out and get us. We're just going to land on. We're going to drop some stuff off. And I can still see him now looking at me as I landed on. We dropped two MFO boxes of, like, you know, crates of Coke, stickies, magazines of a nature I won't repeat on this sort of forum, you know, just because they had nothing. And I remember him looking at me and just giving me the thumbs up as if to say, like, I'm in the Hurt Locker here. Thanks very much for your help and stuff like that. And that's what the job was about. I absolutely love that. It's the fact that we had the tools and the reach to do that sort of stuff for the guys that were in the green zone, and who, you know, unless they got on a helicopter, that was their life, was that green zone. They didn't realize how big Afghanistan was. And, you know, they were fighting a completely different war to what we were fighting. And it was just good to support those guys. And obviously, you know, being Army Air Corps, we've got the Apache as well, which is a different kettle of fish, but how that supported the ground troops as well, I think put the Corps in a very good light with the infantry sort of cohort. There's a couple of other stories that I probably won't go down. Probably because I shouldn't.
I'm just pleased everybody got a copy of the Women's Weekly.
Yeah. And it was, what was it back in the day as well? Nuts and Zoo magazine was a big thing then.
Yeah.
It was just Christ. Yeah. But yeah, there's some really good stuff. We did some really good jobs. That it would be on the cusp of us flying back from Kajaki Dam. We're dropping a guy off who needed to be up there. We'd fly back and someone would go, you know, there's a HF wire hanging from that shack in the mountains, and then you identify that that's a Taliban, you know, command post and things like that, which hadn't been picked up by anyone previously. It was just by chance that you'd spotted it, and then, you know, we'd ask someone with a bigger firearm to deal with that. And it was things like that that we were very, very good at the time. It was good experience.
It's amazing listening to those names like Shawcat and Kajaki Dam, and just, you know, it seems like an age ago, but actually it wasn't really.
No, but someone really needs to make a book of every fob that was there. It'd be amazing.
What an incredible story.
Yeah. And, you know, you think, like, I think 2004 it was 2005, I helped build Camp Smitty in Iraq, which was a Dutch camp. We just filled sandbags for 4 days. And that's really very rarely spoken about. And like you said, Shawcat and, you know, places like that. Fob Edinburgh was obviously a bigger one. So, and things like that, so, and Ulett and stuff like that, Price, you'd remember those. But some of them are really small, where it was like, we've already had one aircraft in today. You're going to have to wait until tomorrow, you know. And I remember going to an outpost where the Pathfinders were, and they were deep in contact with a really, really low ammunition count. And we attempted to fly in, and we come under such severe contact, we had to pull out. And this happened 3 times. And my friend Stu, I won't say his last name. He doesn't serve anymore, but I don't know if he'd appreciate it. But he said, listen to me. He actually lives out here with me in Canada. He said to me, hey, we are going to have to come in because we are so low on fuel. If you want this ammunition, you're just going to have to put as much fire down as you can whilst we come in. So the guys popped smoke. We landed, and it was like the quickest I've ever got mortars and ammunition off that aircraft. I literally just threw it on the floor because we were under such heavy contact. And we flew out of that unscathed, but the ground troops, again, we got a, you know, I think it was about a month later, somebody had taken a photo of us landing in that purple smoke, offloading that ammunition to those guys. And then they'd sent it to us, and it became a picture in, like, sort of like the Army Aviation Museum or something like that. But it's pretty cool. You know, and it was just that element of being able to help those people is awesome. I'll come off this radio show 100%. I'll be like, oh, why don't I tell them that story? Why didn't I tell them that story? That's so much better. But yeah, it was good. Yeah. I've been lucky. I've been really lucky. I've done a lot of stuff in the desert. I've done a lot of stuff in Norway. I've been to the jungle, did some different training out there, which was really good. The jungle was horrible, by the way, if you haven't been. Everything wants to eat you. But flying there is amazing, you know, because you know that the trees are 250 feet high. You know, it's like, they call it the broccoli because it looks like broccoli at night under goggles. But you know that if you put an aircraft into that, you're not coming out. You know, it's 250 feet, that it's difficult. And there's a story of a plane that had crashed in the Malaysian jungle near Penang, like 3 years before we got there. And they still brief it and say, look, if you come across this aircraft, because they've never found it, it just disappeared into the jungle and the jungle basically ate it up. It's really strange. So, you know, it's a dangerous game, but very interesting, very good flying.
Darn, it's been absolutely fascinating.
I just don't know what to say. I knew that you were going to be probably the coolest person I'd ever met, Russ, when I seen your office, and it's full of helicopter parts and really cool photos. And when I was dog walking and we were having a chat and stuff, I thought, this guy is a honorary Mav geek, definitely. So thank you so much for joining us. And isn't it crazy that, you know, we all live together here at Batters, and you don't know everybody's story, but gosh, yeah, when I walk past your house now, I'm just going to be flipping, you know, that's the dude right there. Yeah. So thank you so much for joining us today.
No worries. Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure. And I told you, like I said, I'll get off this and think, oh, why didn't I say that? That's such a better story. But I hope you got something from it. And yeah, it's quite cathartic actually passing on.
Remember, if you do require it, there is support available. That's at bfbs.com/audience support. Do you know what, Jamie? Our armed forces never fail to amaze me.
Just extraordinary, isn't it? And he talks about his experiences with, you know, not a sense of, yeah, that was easy, with a sense of, you know, purpose. And it really was a fascinating listen. And he's put himself in harm's way for, well, for us, really. So all power to Russ. And it was a good get, because I know you're a friend of his, so that's brilliant.
So that's just about it for this week. But please join us next week for a little early Christmas prezi. Oh, I can hear the sleigh bells already. It's the OG Mav Geek, the former Phantom pilot, the British Airways pilot, and now the author of Flavours of Flight. Jamie, let's be honest, he is the third person in our Mav Geek relationship. It is Al Bridger.
I know, both of us in our 50s and fanboying, girling Al like he was a boy band member or something like that. We regret nothing. Listen, don't forget, if you want to get in touch with the programme to suggest a guest or an aircraft that we should talk about, or if you just want to have a chat about one of the episodes, then do get in touch. It's mavgeeks@bfbs.com.
And of course, we are continuing to dominate the airwaves with all things Mav Geeks, as we bring you Mav Geeks on air to BFBS Radio from 6 o'clock UK time on Tuesdays and 1 o'clock UK time on a Saturday. In the words of Gloria Estefan, kind of, Mav Geeks is going to get you.
We'll catch you next week. Have a good one.
Ta-ra!